It's a great delight to be here. You can hear me, right, in the back? It's all working great. And I'm curious, how many of you are at a London Insight event for the first time? And how many of you might be new to this form of meditation practice, Insight Meditation? Okay, great. Well, I was here last year, as Chris said, and I had a big desire to come back. So I kind of arranged things that for this summer so that it would work. I was in Ireland last weekend and have actually spent the intervening 5 days in London with my friend Diana, who's been a delightful guide and support, and I've been a tourist. I'm one of those people now that you fume about, you know, it's like, oh no, this place is getting filled with tourists, but I am one, and it's been fantastic. It's something I virtually never do, and it's been a tremendous amount of fun just to be able to do that. And I, having had the opportunity last year to really focus on loving kindness, I wanted to expand that. Maybe that's part of my deep desire to come back, as well as being with all of you, which was so wonderful last year, into the topic of equanimity. Because equanimity, I really feel in many ways is like the secret ingredient. It's the unspoken power that is part of mindfulness. It's certainly part of loving kindness. It's part of compassion. It's what helps us sustain an effort to try to make a difference through all the ups and downs and ups and downs and twists and turns and exhilarations and disappointments. It's equanimity that allows us to get a whole new vantage point on our own experience so that we're not struggling so much with what's difficult. You know, hating it, trying to make it go away, or feeling betrayed by life because things have taken a difficult turn, and also not getting fooled or beguiled by the really pleasant, wondrous experiences that happen, thinking if I only hold on tightly enough, it will never change. Or somehow I am going to claim this even as I disavow everything else and call this mine, and you know, all the ways that we actually may be adding layers of grasping and control and fear to a very beautiful experience. So it's equanimity that challenges all of that, and yet as a word, it's kind of boring. It seems a little bit flat. It's not that appealing. And I think it's quite interesting, therefore, to begin to explore the nature of that state. So I'm going to start, actually, with just describing a foundation meditation practice, which will be a review for many of you, and talk about some of the role in equanimity, and then we'll get a chance to sit together. We'll also have periods of walking meditation and times that we can get outside. It's a beautiful day. I hear it's going to storm tomorrow, but we don't know when. And I think we'll just have a lot of fun together in a very unusual way. Sometimes I tell this story about, as you know, no doubt, I co-founded a retreat center in Massachusetts called the Insight Meditation Society. And 1 year, quite some years ago, we had a Burmese meditation teacher visiting named Saida Upandita. And he was staying at a house next door to the center. And my friend Ramdas was sitting at the retreat center. And it was the last day of his retreat. It also happened to be the Buddha's birthday, which we celebrate in the full moon of May. It's the day they say the Buddha was born, the day he was enlightened, and then the day that he died. It was all in the full moon of May. So I said to Ramdas, why don't we go over next door at lunchtime to the house that the monk, Sayadaw Pandita, is staying in, because it's the Buddha's birthday. We can celebrate the Buddha's birthday. So Ramdas said, okay, and we went next door. And it turned out that the way that they celebrated the Buddha's birthday was by having us silently sit and watch the monk silently eat. And then having us silently sit as we watched the monk silently get up and move out of the room. So Ramdas turned to me and he said, boy, you Buddhists really know how to throw a party. So it was sort of fun in that sense this day, you know, it was a little different. Like a different sense of fun. Not so giddy, maybe. And having said that, maybe I should say that, you know, from the very first retreat I ever did, my introduction to meditation was in January of 1971 in India. The first night of that retreat, the teacher said, the Buddha did not teach Buddhism, the Buddha taught a way of life. And that has formed the foundation of my perspective. So even though I've been practicing and the tools that I've learned have been, you could say, cradled within that tradition for all of these centuries, we come together not because of Buddhism and not really to explore the nature of Buddhism, but to explore ourselves. And this has formed a very strong understanding for me and a very strong perspective that these are universal truths. These can be discovered within many traditions and outside of traditions as well. The methods that the Buddha described seem very practical, very direct, applicable to anybody who's interested in them. It's not at all about becoming a Buddhist, but for me, since it has been so many years, this tends to be the language that I use, and the imagery and the metaphors are usually from within that tradition, and yet I think it can be translated in countless different ways. And so even as I say, well, according to the Buddha or whatever, you know, you may be having a recognition from something else or even from your own personal experience. The word in Pali, the language of the original Buddhist text, that is usually translated as meditation is the word bhavana. And bhavana actually literally means cultivation. So the idea of meditation is very much that we cultivate the ground. It's like we're cultivating the ground so that some very beautiful qualities can emerge. And this is very different from how we normally may be, which can be in a much more acquisitive mode. Like, I'm going to get some great experience and then I'm going to show it off. Or I will know I am triumphant in meditation when I sit and I'm filled with brilliant white light and bliss. Or I had 5 minutes of peace yesterday, surely it'll be 10 today and 15 tomorrow. And let's see, what time does this end on Sunday? I have until Sunday afternoon sometime to get enlightened, you know. So we can really be very grasping in a way after meditation experience and very judgmental about ourselves if it doesn't seem to be manifesting, like, uh-oh, it's already Sunday at 2, no enlightenment yet. You know, everyone else surely is enlightened in this room. It must be me. And in contrast to that, we have this sense of just cultivating the ground. We're creating the conditions so that insight, love, equanimity, clarity, understanding can emerge. We can't make it happen. We can't, you know, be impatient about it and have that make things happen any faster. My friend Joseph Goldstein tells a story about, I think he was about 9 years old, and he grew his first and I believe his only garden. And he said that when the little green fluffy stuff would start appearing on top of the carrots, he would get so impatient that he would pull them up to help them grow faster. So he didn't have much of a harvest, which may have been why it was his only garden. You know, it's not going to make a difference if we get impatient. We try to make it happen faster. So it's a very different sensibility. We're just cultivating the ground. And in Tibetan Buddhist tradition, there's another way that word bhavana is used, which I like quite a lot, although they also say cultivation. They have a phrase they sometimes use for bhavana, which is getting used to it. Just getting used to it. And the idea here seems to be that it's like a conviction or a feeling that we have had, each of us, very profound moments of peace, of connection, of love, boundless love, of clarity, of understanding, but we don't tend to be awfully used to them. You know, maybe we have an experience and we think, what was that? Or we have an experience and we think, I don't think I'll tell anyone about that. That was really kind of weird. Or we have an experience and we think, I've got to get it back. I don't know how to get it back. How do I, you know? We don't tend to abide in those deepest places that we have genuinely seen and known. And so we practice meditation in a way to get used to them, to make a home in our deepest clarity, love, and understanding, which we have. So it's not like meditation is seen as, you know, you're starting from like nothing. And it's this really bleak, desperate endeavor to somehow, maybe, someday, get a decent sense of the truth. It's not like that. It's really this very strong honoring and respect for our own capacity, which is said to be innate. And it's within everyone. It's not just the special people. It's not just the lucky people. It's not excluding anybody. There's said to be a capacity which we may visit now and then, may have visited now and then. So now we'll look more at learning to dwell there, to abide there, to live from that place. So that's the practice of meditation. And within that, we are just practicing certain skills. So it's like any skill development. It takes time, it takes patience. We need to have a certain kind of perseverance, because right in the middle of something, we can't usually tell how it's going. We need to let go of a lot of expectation and assumption, be willing to enter the unknown. It's really like any kind of skill development. And the first skill that we work with is that of concentration, so that we can have a more stable sense of attention or awareness. It's awareness or attention that becomes our vehicle for everything, for love, for compassion, for equanimity, and so on. But to begin with, we need to stabilize our attention somewhat, because it's usually not very stable. Most of us experience ourselves as fairly distracted, with our attention flying all over the place. We sit down not only to meditate, but to work something through, to think through a dilemma, to come to some resolution. And before we know it, we are gone. In meditation, it may be that we try to settle our attention on a certain object, as we're about to do, and we quickly discover it's not that long before our attention's just flying. When I went to my first meditation retreat all those years ago, when I walked through those monastery gates, I had never meditated for one single second before that moment. And the very first instruction I got was the first practice we're going to do here, which was just sit down and feel your breath. Feel the actual sensations of your in and out breath. And first I was actually quite dismayed, as I often say. I thought, feel my breath? You know, I came all the way to India. What do you mean, feel my breath? You know, where's the magical, esoteric, fantastic technique that's going to ease all of my suffering and make me a happy person? And then I thought, how hard can this be? You know, I'll just do this stupid thing for a while. And what will it be? You know, 800 breaths, 900 breaths before my mind wanders? And to my absolute shock, it was like two. You know, or three, maybe one, maybe a half, just gone. You know, maybe I should live in India forever. Well, maybe not. Maybe I'll go back in 10 years. Just gone. Our minds jump to the past, jump to the future, judgments, speculation. So the process of deepening concentration is one of gathering all that energy, all that attention flying all over the place, and just bringing it together. Now, what we usually discover is that that doesn't last very long. It is one breath, or two breaths, or three breaths. And again, we're distracted, we're lost. But that's okay, because the most important moment in the meditation practice is actually the moment when you realize you've been distracted. That time's already gone. But then comes a moment when the great temptation is just to judge ourselves mercilessly. I can't believe I'm thinking. I'm so stupid. No one else in the room is thinking. They're sitting here in bliss. I'm the only one who's thinking. Why am I thinking? They're not thinking. And if they were thinking, they'd be thinking beautiful thoughts. They'd be thinking loving thoughts. They must be thinking very spiritual thoughts. I don't have those spiritual thoughts. I'm just thinking about, you know, the traffic pattern in London. Why am I thinking about the traffic pattern in London? I'm not in charge of the traffic pattern in London. And anyway, I figured that all out last sitting. Why am I thinking about that? You know, it's so tempting to do that. But instead, we are invited, right in that moment when we realize we've been distracted, to see if we can just let go and begin again. Just bring your attention back to that object of meditation. And if you have to let go and begin again 10 billion times, that's absolutely fine. That's really the deepening of concentration. So the kind of immediate sense we get is being distracted, being scattered, losing energy, because the energy is not available to us. It's just flying all over the place. The more kind of larger sense that we get from a lack of concentration is a sense of fragmentation. It's the way our lives can be so compartmentalized. We don't feel integrated. We don't feel whole. The way people say sometimes that they feel like they're one person at work and a different person at home. Our lives can be really divided in those ways. I was teaching in New York City and once, and somebody said to me what I've often said as a joke. She said, "I feel filled with loving kindness and compassion for all beings everywhere, as long as I'm alone. But once I'm with others, it's rough." And I said, oh, people really say that. Look at that. Or we can feel the opposite. We can feel very connected and at ease as long as we are with others, but very ill at ease being alone. And so here, too, it's like we're bringing our energy together. We're bringing all facets of our being together. We're learning how to rest in this moment just through the simple art of concentration. So in terms of meditation practice, what we do is we choose an object, we gather our attention around it, and when we discover the attention has slipped, we come back. So that means equanimity, which means balance. because we're not really evaluating what has taken our attention away. We're not saying, oh good, best thought in the entire universe, let me think it through and then I'll change the world. We're also not thinking, oh, that's the most dreadful thought anyone has ever had. I can't believe I'm still thinking such things. All these years later, I'm the worst meditator that's ever lived. It's just like you notice that you've left that object very gently. Just let go. It's no problem. See if you can let go and begin again. Now, that object can be anything. It could be a mantra, it could be a visualization, it could be a prayer. Very often in this particular school of meditation, this tradition, we tend to use something like the breath. Because, first of all, the breath is available to us no matter where we are. If we practice in this kind of formal sense, okay, I'm spending a weekend, I'm meditating, I'm with a group of people, then we can also practice sitting in some form of public transportation, sitting in traffic, standing in line somewhere, waiting, being in a contentious meeting at work. Wherever we are, as long as we're breathing, we can be meditating. So that's one reason the breath is so commonly chosen. So that's the first practice we're going to do here together. And I'll guide you through it as we do it. You might want to stretch or even take a short break, but short, okay? And then come back and we'll have this sitting.